And of course, the advantage is you don't have to sum over spin structures. So for tree amplitudes, there are two advantages. No sum over spin structures. Of course, that doesn't help with trees. The other advantage is the Ramon states, Ramon vertex operators, are as simple as easy as the Rishulis. So this is, of course, in RNS, this is an additional difficulty. I think for tree amplitudes, I think people have done up to 6 fermions by now, but it's a mess. I'm not going to go into why it's a mess, but if you try to do it, it's a mess. And of course, this is, both of these are a result of the fact that we have space-time supersymmetry. I'll put this in quotation marks for a reason you'll see soon. Okay, so first tree amplitude. So let's do first three-point amplitude. So I'll only discuss massless here, although massive, it's just, it's the same prescription, it's just things get more complicated. So the first non-trivial is, of course, three-point. So I'll do flat background. In principle, one can do this in curve, but life is more complicated. So in ADS, I will say some factors at the some new features at the end. But well, maybe I can give some motivation so you stay awake. There's some features in ADS which seem to be simpler conceptually than in flat, and maybe that's deep, maybe it's not. So we have three of these. Now I'm putting the unintegrated vertex operator. So this is supposed to remind you in bosonic string theory of this type of vertex operator. C, probably doing three tachyons. Let's do three massless vector would be something like this. Okay. So I'm writing things in X space, but of course A alpha of X and theta, you can write in momentum space. So it's just E to the IKX times something which remembers the polarization. So for example, the vector polarization sits here. And the fermion sits so just doing the theta expansion, you can figure out how the polarizations enter. Okay. But of course, the advantage is you don't. Oh, okay. So we can dig out all the different scattering amplitudes, but it's easy to just work in terms of this superspace. Okay. So the thing we have to do is decide what this bracket means. Okay. So for three-point function, all we have is zero modes. There's no OPEs. Everything is dimension zero. Unlike, for example, in bosonic string, where this already has excitation. So all we have to do is decide the rules for integrating over the zero mode. As I already mentioned Wednesday, the naive rules would be d16 theta, d11 lambda, d10x.
Sorry, can you say again why there are zero modes?
OK, so this is, these are dimension zero objects. If you're doing three-point tree amplitude, there's no, just because of conformal invariance, there's no OPEs between any of these. So there's no Z dependence to this. There's no integration over the Zs if you're doing a three-point amplitude. So the non-zero modes only enter through the partition function. For tree amplitudes, the partition function is just a normalization factor. For loop amplitudes, the partition function is relevant because you have to integrate over moduli of the surface, and it can depend on the moduli. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what we want to do is compute this object here. So now we have lambda a cubed. Now, just by dimensional analysis, we know what we want to get. We're supposed to get, for the three-point amplitude, we're just supposed to get chi 1, a slash 2, chi 3. So this is just the usual Yukawa coupling, and then you have a term also, so where the indices here are contracted. and then plus permutation.
Chi is a polarization, right?
Chi is the fermion, the gluino, gaugino. A is the gluon. So this is just the usual, this is a trace.
Yeah, but it's not a field, right?
I'm sorry?
It's not a field. It's
so you can either think of it in momentum space, in which it's just the polarizations. So then in that case, it would be, when you do the integral over x, it would just be multiplied by the usual, you know, delta k1 plus k2 plus k3.
Yeah, because it's the analog of AM, right? For fermions.
That's right.
Okay, so it's a polarization.
Yeah, you want to think of it that way. Okay, so of course this is, if we're doing abelian, this is zero. So it's only the non-abelian one that's non-zero. So the commutative is here when you do the permutation. Okay, so I'm ignoring the Champeyton factors. Mm-hmm. So just looking at what order theta should contribute, well, each A contributes with 1, each chi contributes with 2. So to get this, obviously, you should have an integral over 5 thetas. If you try to do an integral with more than 5 thetas, you're going to get 0, just because you're going to get momentum factors which are going to vanish using the on-shell identity. So this is supposed to be equal to something like d5 theta. Now, obviously, you have 3 lambdas, but there's no lambdas here.
Well, let me see. First you wrote what you want to get, and now you are...
Yeah, I'll explain where it comes. So obviously, this integral over lambda is somehow going to have to just remove 3 lambdas. And then you have this expression, lambda A here. Now the only thing left is to somehow contract the indices. Now there's only one way to contract these indices, which is, there are different ways to say it, but one way to say it is, there's a unique way to construct something out of 3 thetas and 3 lambdas and 5 thetas, which is this one. So we're going to define this object to be 1. If we define this object to be 1, then this amplitude, so this is obviously Lorentz invariant, then this amplitude gives the right answer with this prescription. So this is a prescription. Later I'll explain where the prescription comes from. So of course you can also write it in this form by just contracting the indices according to something which pulls out this term. Okay. Is it clear or is it?
No, not much.
Okay. So this is a Lorentz scalar. This object here depends on 3 lambdas and many thetas. And we want to pull out the term in this product of lambdas and thetas, which has precisely this form. Now you can do it by just defining the indices here appropriately. So okay, let me do it more carefully. So dd lambda. Remember that integrals over theta are like derivatives with respect to theta. So I can pull out this term by just doing this.
What do you mean by that arrow there? You mean instead?
This one?
Instead
this is supposed to be equal. After defining what I mean by this.
Okay, so now you are trying to define what you mean by that.
So right now I'm just telling you what this is. I didn't tell you the indices here.
And at the end you put lambda equal to 0, I guess, right? Or lambda equal to 0.
Yeah. I mean, after you take the derivative with respect to 3 lambdas, there's nothing to put to 0, because there's only a cubic in lambda. But the thetas, yes, you put the thetas to 0 after. Okay, so what I mean is to pull out this term, I'm just doing the obvious thing. So this is the expressions I mean here. Okay, now let me give you some understanding of where this comes from. So, as I already mentioned Wednesday, you have, if you don't do this, you would have, this would give you a power of 11 zeros, And this would give you power of 11 infinities. So the way to go from here to here is to somehow regularize this 0 over 0. Okay, now there are different ways of doing the regularization. The way that's going to be most convenient is introducing these additional non-minimal variables. Now if you want, you can forget about non-minimal variables for tree amplitudes and just use this prescription. Okay, you don't ever have to introduce the non-minimal variables for the tree amplitudes. You just have to remember to use this prescription. That's very powerful, and for example, Carlos Mafra has done a lot of work on using this prescription. You get, you know, all these B, C, J, whatever identities in a nice way, because essentially everything is already written in superspace. So all these identities that are related to supersymmetry just fall out naturally from this. Now,
sorry, when you take this, I mean, if you had the gates, you have the starting point, the thing with the gate symmetry is not fixed. I mean, you should be able to derive these measures somehow.
Yeah, so.
Can this be used kind of to go backwards and understand where they came from?
Well, I will derive this measure. I mean, I don't need to go backwards. The measure will come from this. This is the right measure. It's just you have to regularize it.
But if you, I think what I'm saying is that if you had the Gates invariant formulation,
yes,
and you follow a standard rule, it would give you the regulated measure to begin with.
Sorry, maybe the word regularized isn't you don't know what I mean by regularized. It will give you some expression which is has zero over zeros. You have to regularize it. The regularization that you choose is irrelevant. You'll always get the same answer. As long as you do the regularization in a BRST invariant way. It has to be BRST invariant.
Yes.
But obviously, so if you go back one step, it will have to be consistent with whichever symmetry came from. But you would still have to do the regularization.
That's fine, but.
So it will explain where the BRST operator came from. So. Okay, so. So let me just repeat what I said Wednesday. So the. One way to regularize, there are a few ways to regularize. This is the most convenient way, which helps you do loop amplitude. Mm-hmm. So there are other regularizations involving contour integrals which are less convenient when you want to generalize two loops. The one which I find convenient, and other people have also found convenient, is introducing these non-minimal variables. So you introduce a new set of variables. I'll call them lambda bar.
So this definition with d5 theta, with this particular choice of indices, this is not the general definition.
This is the general definition, but it will come from regularizing this. So
why isn't it enough to just replace as you do?
Just define it?
Yeah.
Suppose we now want to do loops.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so this is fine for tree. For loops, there are also non-zero modes. So we have to understand also how to handle the non-zero modes. And once you introduce the non-minimal variables, it will become clear what the loop generalization of this is. So all this is, for tree amplitudes, that's all you need. But when you go to loops, these non-minimal variables will play an important role. It may be that the fundamental version of the formalism already involves these non-minimal variables. That may be true. So what you do is you introduce a set of bosons which have the opposite chirality from the pure spinners. So they're still pure spinners, lambda bar gamma m lambda bar equals zero. But instead of having an up alpha index, they have a down alpha index. So these are not the right movers. These are, so I'm doing open string here. Okay, I'm not doing closed string. And now the fermionic counterpart of them, I'll call R and S. So these are conformal weight 0, and these are conformal weight 1. So these are the conjugates to these. Just to distinguish them from the lambdas. I could have called it another letter. Yeah. Okay. And if you want, you can interpret them as the complex conjugates of lambda. If you work in Euclidean target space, complex conjugations flips the chirality. Okay, so Now the action is going to be the original action. Plus, the terms come from here. So you have W bar. Now this will be D bar. They're still left moving. So sorry for the too many bars. But and if you're doing type 2, you would also have the hatted version of this. Okay, so why do we do this? It's because now Q has an additional piece. So instead of being just lambda alpha d alpha, it has an additional piece, which is R alpha W bar, which means using the usual quartet mechanism that the cohomology is independent of these.
What mechanism?
So if you add a term which is quadratic of this type in a BRST operator and compute the cohomology, you find that the cohomology, so anything which depends on R or W bar is BRST trivial, and anything which depends on its conjugate, which would be S or lambda bar, is not BRST closed. So what it means is that any dependence on these variables or their conjugate momentum is not, states in the cohomology are independent of these variables. So it doesn't affect the cohomology computation. So this is, well, it's called the quartet mechanism because you have these four fields. Yes?
Is the difference between the first term and the d alpha is not?
Oh, d alpha is not the. That's right. So d alpha. So you're asking why doesn't this also tell you that the thing is independent of lambda and d?
One or the other, perhaps.
Yeah, so the distinction is that, well, these objects, yeah, okay. There's one more thing I forgot to say. So. The unusual feature is that these objects are constrained, so because of this constraint. And in order for this constraint to be consistent with the VST operator, you also have to put a constraint on R. Because if I commute this constraint with this, I will get lambda bar gamma r equals here. So there are actually 11 of these and 11 of these. That's the difference here. Here you have 11 of these and you have 16 of these. So that's why it doesn't kill all of that. Okay, so why are these useful?
Sorry, they turn from trivially under PSU to whatever?
I'm not doing ADS. You're asking in
Under
Poincaré, they just transform. They're invariant under space-time supersymmetry, and they rotate in the usual way under Poincaré. Another question? Okay, so why is this useful? It's useful because now I can introduce a regulator. So I insert something into this integral. So now I integrate over everything.
Sorry. Yeah. This stuff that you added to the action is Q of something. That's what you're saying, right?
Or am I? This term here is Q of something, yes. That's right.
The extra stuff that you added.
Yes.
And you said, I think you're trying to say why it's obvious, right? That it's Q of something by its
result. Let's write it. What is it Q of? It's Q of. S alpha. D bar, lambda bar alpha. Yeah. So Q of this S gives you this term here. Q of this gives you this term here.
Because they are
Okay. Okay. So. Okay, so now instead of doing the original integral, now we're going to do this integral.
These are all commuting.
These are commuting, these are anti-commuting.
Oh, okay, that's right.
So you use an equal set of commuting.
R to B bar is D bar lambda.
So now the there's a nice BRST invariant object you can construct, which is Q of theta alpha lambda bar alpha. So this is equal to E to the lambda alpha, minus lambda bar alpha plus theta alpha r alpha. So of course this is 1 plus something BRST trivial, so it doesn't affect whatever I'm going to integrate here, which in this case is lambda a cubed. So this amplitude without this is supposed to be describing this. And now we put in this regulator. Well, let's call this N. Doesn't matter where you put it because it's almost BRST trivial. It's 1 plus something BRST trivial.
So first you add something to the action which is completely decoupled from the rest, right?
That's right.
A new variable.
That's right.
No one cares. So now you put some...
So these obviously... That's right. So the partition function for these cancel each other out because they're not in the cohomology. But now we put in a regulator which allows you to cancel the 0 over zeros here. So this is...
It's not completely obvious to me why there are 11 R's. Because you said R is anti-commuter.
Right, but it replaces the
constraint. Similar kind of pure spinner constraint. Isn't that a trivially 0 because it's anti-commuting that?
Let's do the counting.
And if it were non-trivial... For a commuting one, it's going to be trivial for an anti-commuting one.
Sorry, so it's not R gamma R equals 0. It's lambda bar gamma R equals 0.
So, but that's equally non-obvious why that...
So let me explain why it kills... the way I would say it is you choose lambda bar in a certain direction. You choose lambda bar in a certain direction.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's choose it so that the only component that's non-vanishing is this one, and all the other components are vanishing. And now you ask, so R under SO10 over U5 splits up into a 1, so it has the opposite chirality, so it starts down here. So it's R plus RAB and RA. So this is a 5, 10 bar and 1. And now this constraint here, you can show it kills these. So you just search with these 11. So, that's why it has 11 instead of 16. So, of course, this was done with lambda bar here, but you could, of course, do a Lorentz rotation and it's always 11. Okay, so this trick is. Everybody uses it. I mean, this localization thing is related to this. All of these regularization techniques essentially come down to this type of regulator. You write something which is almost BRST trivial, 1 plus something BRST trivial, and it kills zeros over zeros.
That is because, I guess, the original action was kind of singular.
That's right.
The kinetic terms.
Yeah, I mean the path integral is singular.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Well, it's not singular. It's 0 over 0.
Okay. I don't know what the right word is.
Yeah, I don't.
Indeterminate.
Yeah, something like that.
So, you want to extract some cohomology of Q at some particular level.
That's another way to say it. Yes.
This regulator isn't yet telling me anything about which level. I can expand this out into as many.
Are you talking about ghost number? Wait, level, you mean ghost number. Is that what you mean, level?
I guess so.
Yeah, okay. So, but the ghost number here is fixed by, this carries ghost number 0 because lambda bar has ghost number minus 1 and Q has ghost number plus 1. So the ghost number is 3. Okay, so now...
Sorry. So suppose I wasn't interested... some crazy reason in computing scattering amplitudes in 10 dBm mills, but I wanted to just insert another vertex operator such that the ghost number wasn't 3.
Yeah?
Could I just
No, I think that in this formalism, the Gauss number anomaly is fixed. So as in bosonic string theory, you could have asked, well, suppose instead of putting three C's here, I'd put five C's. But I get something interesting. No, because you get zero. Of course, if you change the theory so that it has a different U1 anomaly, a Gauss number anomaly, then you can. But with this theory, the Gauss number anomaly is fixed. Okay, so how to evaluate this? Well, obviously, the integration over lambda bar, that's a Gaussian. I know how to do it. The only subtlety is that it's a Gaussian with constrained variables. There's some techniques that my student knows that I don't know, but Umberto Gomez worked out this, and you know it involves, I don't even know the words, but there are methods for computing, actually not just, I mean, I know how to get everything except the overall coefficient. He knows also how to get the overall coefficient. And he used it to check that, you know, that the overall coefficient agrees with what you get in RNS, for example.
Can you tell him what the flavor of it is?
Yeah, you should ask him to give a seminar. He was here 2 weeks ago, I think. Umberto Gomez. So the flavor is you have this space CP, I guess it's 15, of a projective ordinary spinner.
Uh-huh.
I'm referring to the, so there's a paper.
What is the paper?
So it was about 2 years ago. So the goal was to compute the two loop. So the reason was because there's a conjecture of S duality for the type 2B string fixes the two loop coefficient to be something like, I don't remember what it is, but it's some function that is, it's some number that is fixed by the, you know, Green and Gutperl have a conjecture for the r to the fourth term.
Yes.
And not only for the r, right, for the r to the fourth term, and it, the r to the fourth term gets tree and one loop, and the d to the fourth r to the fourth term gets tree and two loop. So they have explicit conjectures for this, these coefficients to all orders in, I mean, non-perturbatively also, but also the coefficients for the tree level and loop contribution. So in RNS, it turns out the two-loop coefficient, you can't compute it directly because it involves some chiral determinants that people don't know how to do with two loops. In this formalism, it turns out you don't get any of these chiral determinants. I'll say it when I get to the loop amplitude. And so essentially, the only thing left to do is to compute this overall coefficient. And so that's what he did. Umberto did the computation at one loop by himself and got the right coefficient, obviously. And then with Carlos Maffra, they computed the two-loop and got it. So it's about maybe 1 or 2 years ago, if you look up. So the name is Umberto Gomez, who's graduating this year, so it's an advertisement for postdoc also. Okay, so actually Carlos is going to Cambridge.
His collaborator.
Carlos Maffra, yeah.
How do you spell that name? Not the
Carlos. Carlos?
Maffra.
Yeah, he's very good. So the Gaussian part we know how to do. The integration over R is also straightforward because it's just 11 R's. The only thing you have to be a little bit careful of is the R's are constrained. But it's essentially straightforward. You can do an integration over 16 R's and just put in, you know, five delta functions in this, and you do the integration over R. And you guess, of course, that this thing reduces to just the prescription here. Okay, if it was just doing tree amplitudes, obviously you add all this stuff and you just get back to some easy answer. There's not much point. But now we want to do groups. Okay. So, of course, you can also do endpoint amplitudes. Endpoint amplitudes, you just have to insert here DZR. Now you have the integrated vertex operator. So, and you, of course, you product R equals 4 to N. And these were these integrated vertex operators I wrote down for you. I guess
when why do you call it amplitude and not correlation function or official operator?
So correlation function, I think of, so there's the space-time correlation function and the worldsheet correlation function. So the worldsheet correlation function I think of as OPEs. You're asking about the space-time correlation function?
Can we come to the effective action, three level effective?
So this is usually called the S matrix amplitude.
No, you get the S matrix and you get the
S. So the correlation function I usually think of is if you have
these fields have to be on shell.
The states are all on shell, yes. Maybe that's the reason why. Yeah, we don't know how to do string theory. We don't know how to use conformal field theory techniques when the states are off shell. We can do string field theory, but we can't do conformal field. Okay. Okay, so now loops. So obviously the answers all agree with RNS, and the advantage is that they're written in superspace in the sense that you integrate, you know, you have an expression which is just integrated over five thetas. Okay, and it's powerful. But in some sense manifest is in quotations because it's not an integration over 16. So to show that something is space-time supersymmetric, it turns out to be space-time supersymmetric up to a BRST trivial. Okay. So the reason is because if you just integrate over five thetas, well, it's not obvious that, so the way you prove something is supersymmetric if it's integration over 16 thetas is that a supersymmetry transformation is realized as something like dd theta. So this becomes, dd 16 thetas, dd theta 16, dd theta. So this vanishes just because you have too many dd thetas. Now, if I just have five thetas here, it's not so obvious that this thing is equal to zero. Okay. And the way to prove it is zero is you have to use the fact that f is BRST closed. You can show that anything which is BRST closed, when you do this, gives you zero. Now that sounds like harmonic superspace. So BRST closed is some kind of condition that relates terms of different thetas. So if you have some harmonic superspace or chiral superspace, so for example, in four dimensions, if you have a chiral superfield, you don't have to integrate over all the thetas. You can integrate just over half the thetas. So this is, of course, not half, but it's some version of that. Okay, so that's the, but it's only on shell. So, of course, for something to be, for this to work, you have to use that this object is BRST closed. So, and that's.
Nathan, I mean, in the harmonic case, you yes. use variables, and then you show there's a subspace, which is invariant under
yes.
Planck superpoincare, which only contains, you know, so many, that's smaller than the thetas.
Right.
So that's purely a mathematical statement about representation theory.
Right.
Superpoincare represented, realized in terms of
right.
transformation. So that's done here. I mean, you can.
But it's off shell and harmonic. Here it's on. Here it has. So when it's on shell, yes, you can use this kind of representation.
There's some set of variables which you presume are your variables, such yes. that you can realize the superpoincare invariance on only five thetas.
Right. When the states are on shell.
I see.
So you can't do it off shell, but when the states are on shell, yes.
So you have to use.
So you have. Yeah. So this is related to this ectoplasm thing that so the constraints on the superfield somehow allow you to express it just in terms of functions of five theta. Okay. So if I don't have time, I probably will have. I'll save time to get to. But in ADS, the new feature is that it seems you should be able to integrate over all the thetas. So in that sense. The computation should be, in some sense, manifest the PSC24 invariant and not just up to something BRST closed, BRST true. Okay, so loops. So let me quickly say how to do loops. I assume nobody here is interested in the details of loops. Nobody is doing loop computation. So let me just say roughly how it works. So the prescription for loop amplitude, so let's do a general G loop amplitude. In this case, you're going to have n. So of course, let's do close just to, I mean, we can do either open or close. So you have the integrated vertex operator. Now let me do open just so I don't have to say everything twice. So you have the integrated vertex operator, which is integrated over the world sheet. You also have an integration over the Teichmuller parameters. So you have 3g minus 3 Teichmuller parameters, which describe the surfaces which are not conformally equivalent. And now there's an additional thing you have to insert, which is something which is a measure factor, which tells you how to weigh the surfaces of different Teichmuller, of different modulus. So the way that's usually done is you insert B ghosts. With what's called Beltrami differentials. So these mu's for each tau, let's call it I, you have a mu. And these are essentially the duals to the tau's in such a way that if you change your parameterization of the Teichmuller space, you also change the Beltrami differentials such that this is invariant. So this would be the prescription in bosonic string theory. So you can see that if we just count ghost number, the ghost number for the tree amplitude, you had 3C ghosts. Now you have 3G minus 3B ghosts. So it's this Riemann-Roch theorem that the ghost number, it's always, well, it's 3G minus the ghost number anomaly says that on genus G, you need 3 minus 3G, ghost number 3 minus 3G.
And the bosonic thing, it's more than a prescription. That's what you derive it from the polyacoustic.
Good. Okay. But obviously, the prescription is BRST invariant. Okay, so now we can go backwards. We're not going to derive it from some Polyakov. We're just going to say, well, we want a prescription which is BRST invariant. That essentially fixes you to this. But I didn't tell you what B is yet. Okay, so that's
you have
the.
No B's, right?
So that's the. Sorry?
You have no B's in your command.
Right, so there's no fundamental world sheet variable called B. But now we're going to define B by asking that QB is equal to the stress tensor. So the stress tensor is, of course, just dx dx plus PD theta. Plus WD lambda. And if I also introduce these non-minimal variables, you'll also have W bar okay, so you Q is of course well known. Q is this. This. And it's easy to show that T is BRC closed. So now this is just a cohomology question. Is T BRC trivial or not? And of course, the answer is that it is BRC trivial. And now I have to tell you what B is. So now you'll see why these non-minimal variables are so useful. So you can write B. I'll write it. I mean, it's going to look like a mess. But OK, that's life. There's a term. So this term divided by this term, if you take Q of it, using just this term, you'll get T. Okay, so Q of this object here will give you lambda alpha times T. And when you contract the lambda alpha with the lambda bar alpha and divide by this, you just get T. Well, this part of T. But the second term in Q does not commute with it, because this has a lambda bar and this has a W bar. So you have a further term which needs to be canceled. So to cancel it, you add a term with lambda bar and an R. Okay? And it turns out to be this form. Actually, there's another term, which is this term, if you take this part of Q on this, it cancels. Okay. Unfortunately, the second term doesn't cancel this. And OK, there are actually two more terms you have to add. I'm just going to write it in. single term of this type divided by lambda lambda q. And the final term is something like this. Okay, and that's the end of the story. Okay, that's the Bigos. Now, it looks very complicated. Q is relatively simple. The Bigos is relatively complicated. Understand?
I guess I shouldn't worry about having these lambdas in the denominator.
We will worry. Okay. So for the, but let me just, okay, so it has these four terms. If you wanted to say this in contour integrals, so if I hadn't introduced the non-minimal variables, what you'd find is that you have the Bigos is not globally defined in this pure spinner space, projective pure spinner space, and you have Bigos which sits on single overlaps, double overlaps, etc. So that's another way if you want to, if you don't want to use the non-minimal variables, that's how you would construct this Bigos. But at least for computations, I mean, the way you do the computation is you plug this into here and do the path integral. Okay. Now again, we're going to have to introduce a regulator similar to the regulator here. Except now, of course, the regulator is going to have to depend on zero modes that also regulate. So for loop amplitudes, you have more zero modes. You have the lambda zero modes, but you also start to get zero modes for the Ws. So and also, of course, the W bars. Because conformal weight one fields will start to have zero modes on higher genus surfaces. So this N also involves things involving W. So you have terms like S alpha, W alpha. So if you look at this, you'll get e to the minus lambda lambda bar plus theta r plus W W bar plus S d. So you have also now a Gaussian integration over the zero modes of W. Okay, so the regulator is more complicated, but it's essentially just a Gaussian integrations you have to do. So this is what was done explicitly, as I told you, by these people for the one loop and two. Now, of course, one has to do the integrations over the zero modes. If you have lots of external states, it gets to be a mess. But it turns out for the four-point massless amplitude, so the showing that the amplitude vanishes for less than 4 points is trivial. It's just zero mode counting. So the first one, which is non-trivial, is the 4 point. And you find at least at one loop and two loops, it's very straightforward to do the computation. For higher loops, it's more complicated.
So is it for massless?
For massless. It's just for massless. In RNS, what has been done is one loop and two loop, 4 point, but just for external bosons. So this is the first time it's been done also for external fermions. Okay, so the you can extend to higher loops, and you can, especially, for example, it's useful for proving non-enormalization theorems. I'm not going to go into that, but for example, proving that it vanishes for less than 4 points, it's easy to prove for arbitrary genus. So that proves these vanishing theorems. And you can also prove that at up to genus 5, there are these renormalization theorems related to finiteness. And you can prove that, there are these conjectures that the way the effective action grows, the contribution to the effective grows, the number of derivatives here grows with the genus, is something like, it's d to the fourth r to the fourth at two loops. So it's, I think it's this. So there's a conjecture that above genus g, there are no terms with fewer than 2g derivatives on the r to the fourth. Okay. If this were true to all genus, it would prove that n equals 8 supergravity is fine. It turns out that you can explicitly check this up to 5 loops, okay, using this. But actually, the formalism suggests that beyond 5 loops, it's not true anymore. So, of course, you can't prove it's not true, because you would have to actually compute the coefficient and show that the coefficient is non-vanishing. But at least there's no argument why this should hold true for arbitrary genes. And, of course, if it doesn't, then there's no reason to believe that... I don't see any reason to believe n equals 8 is fine. Okay, so so that was a side comment. I mean, if people want, I can say more, but then I won't have time to do the other thing.
Did you comment yet on yes. the lambdas in the denominator?
Good, okay. So what goes wrong at 5 loops? Okay, so this integral here, if I didn't put in the regulator, it would have divergences. When lambda lambda bar goes to infinity, these divergences are regularized. Because you have a Gaussian cutoff. But what about divergences when lambda lambda bar goes to zero? Okay, so when do you get divergences when lambda lambda bar goes to zero? So you can see that because of you're integrating over 11 lambdas and 11 lambda bars, you automatically get a factor of lambda lambda bar to the 11. So in order to have a divergence, you would have to accumulate 1 over lambda lambda bar to the 11th coming from these inverse factors here. So when you get too many b-ghosts, at one loop, you essentially can do it with one b-ghost. At two loops, you have three. At three loops, you have six. So at three loops, you could... Two loops, I have three. Three loops, I have six. Oh, okay, right. This term only gives 1 over lambda lambda bar. But here you'd get more and more. So depending on which of these terms contribute, you could start to have problems if you have, for example, six b-ghosts, because you could start to get contributions from these. So at three loops...
Even with only three of them, 3 times 4 is 12.
Right, so if...
And that's more than 11.
That's right. So, but, okay, let's do the counting carefully. Okay, this has a lambda bar in the numerator. So actually, this term, I said it wrong, this term actually doesn't give you any 1 over lambda lambda bars, because you get also a lambda in the numerator from someplace else. So actually, this goes like... This goes like 1 over lambda lambda bar, this goes like 1 over lambda bar squared, this is 1 over lambda lambda bar cubed. So at two loops, you're safe. At three loops, you could start to get contributions if these terms turn out to be relevant. Okay, these terms have less of these Wiltshire variables in them. So these Wiltshire variables are necessary in order to soak up the zero modes. So at genus G, each of the Ds, so these are the fermionic variables, has a zero mode. So there's 16 G of these zero modes. So obviously, as G grows, you have to have more and more of these. But if you have a sufficiently large number of vertex operators at three loops, these can start to give problems. Okay, so, and at five loops, if you have four of these, then you already get problems. So that's why the regulator needs to be modified at five loops. And when you modify the regulator, it turns out that changes the derivative dependence. So, the formula d to the 2 gr to the 4th essentially follows if you only have to use this regulator. This regulator here. But this regulator is insufficient when you have these divergences. And that's what changes the behavior. Okay, so it's a subtle point, but it's an important subtle point. So, yeah?
I understand. Something here is the trivial effect in whether it's divergent, whether it
oscillators finite?
Okay, so the choice of the regulator. Okay, so this you have to obviously regularize. Okay, if you just use this regulator, you haven't completely regularized. You'll get more zeros over zeros. So obviously the
so that isn't regulator.
This isn't a sufficiently strong enough regulator. It is not it's not an adequate regulator. This one here,
yeah.
When you have these divergences, you have to use another regulator. I'll call it n tilde. N tilde turns out to also involve d zero mode. So this regulator involves d zero mode, but it involves it in a relatively simple way. The other regulator involves even more d zero modes. The thing that allows the this behavior is if most of the
it's not actually regulating the divergence. It's still just regulating the zero over zero.
Zero over zero are the divergence. I just didn't tell you this divergence from here. You also get zeros from the R's and S's. I mean, always when you have a divergence, the physical amplitude doesn't diverge. So these divergences are always canceled by extra zeros. But the signal that you need a regulator is when you have these divergences. So the point is that once you have these divergences, or potential divergences, you have to modify the regulator. Modify maybe is not the right word. You have to change the regulator. The regulator that you're using here is not adequate. I mean, I'm obviously I'm not saying it clearly because it would take some time to develop the way to say it clearly, but I would have to show to you how this behavior is related to the counting of zero mode. So it comes from just counting how many d's you have. So this, to get this dependence, it's related to the fact that you need to absorb ...16g d zero modes. Essentially, as you go higher and higher in genus, you need to absorb more and more zero modes, which means you have to get that the number of derivatives coming from the vertex operators have to be more and more. Okay, that's where this behavior comes from.
Suppose I have an n double tilde, which
yes.
does regularize all divergences.
Yes, yes. But I called it n tilde, you called it double tilde.
Yeah,
yes.
Mine is not the same as yours.
Yes.
But they differ by the rest too. What's the,
then they have this exactly the same effect. Then the answer is the same. As soon as you've regularized, you're guaranteed, as you said, that BRST trivial differences don't affect anything. But you can't compare n with n tilde because this one doesn't regularize. So if you use this, you get 0 over 0. You wouldn't know how to evaluate it. Okay. So it's somewhat similar to the tree amplitude. I mean, if you were silly, you would say, well, this gives you 0, right? But no, it doesn't give you zero because you get zero over zero. You have to put in the regulator. So you might say, well, you're introducing something to BRST trivial. How can it change something zero to something non-zero? It doesn't. It's just that this is not zero. It's zero over zero. The same case here. Okay. So that's the summary of loops. I mean, I'm happy. I want to save maybe some time in the end for this topological stuff. But are there any things that people would like to be clarified here or said a little more?
The structure also survives in the ADS case?
I will get to that.
So do you know n tilde explicitly that works to all loops?
We know n tilde, but the word explicitly is not. We don't know how to compute using it. So nobody has done a computation of, for example, this overall coefficient using n tilde. It's a mess. So if by explicitly you mean have people done explicit computations where you get the non-vanishing number using n tilde, the answer is no. But in principle, there's nothing that would stop you from using it at any loop order. Okay, but it's an open problem to explicitly compute using.
But still, you have a prediction for how n equals 8 diverges of 5 loops or particles up to an overall coefficient.
No, so the way you said it, so there's no reason using n tilde why the amplitude should vanish. Okay? But to explicitly show that it doesn't vanish, you would have to compute using it and show that the coefficient you get is non-zero. And nobody's done that computation.
Yes, but still, you give us something how fast it diverges times an overall coefficient, which is possibly zero.
Right.
So what is
your... So the expectation is that after 5 loops, this behavior stays the same. So it always goes like d to the... I think it's actually d to the 8 out of the 4. So there's no... Right. So the difference was that okay. Let me try to remember. So there are certain types of. So the original expectation was it would start to diverge at 7 loops, and the difference was that. So this was. Okay, so let me think of the best way to say this. So suppose you do the computation and you get something proportional to d to the 10r to the 4. So this part of the computation comes just from the vertex operator. Okay, so essentially, each of the vertex operator has gravitons, and it has derivatives of gravitons, et cetera. And I can just pull out, you know, if I just do a linearized expansion, this has just a certain number of derivatives on the graviton. But there's a possibility of getting inverse derivative factors, which you have to be careful about, coming from places where the surface degenerates. So if you have a surface that degenerates into two surfaces. So for example, this could be some genus G surface, and this could be another one. It's possible to get factors of 1 over k squared coming from the region where, you know, this tube here becomes infinite. So naively, it looked like you're only getting this type of dependence, but I was ignoring the fact that you can get inverse powers of the determinant, inverse powers of k squared coming from regions when the surface degenerates. So the generic surface wouldn't give you this 1 over k squared, but after integrating, after doing this integration over the Teichmuller parameters, you can get extra factors of 1 over k squared. So that changed the derivative dependence. So now there's a weaker version, which is, I mean, again, we don't know that these coefficients are not vanishing. But this is the weakest version that we can prove. So assuming that these give factors of 1 over k squared, the amount of derivatives was lowered. Okay, so that changed. This was maybe 3 years ago. And there's been papers on this by Van Hove. And so we wrote the paper together with Russo, Van Hove, and Green, where we actually use this for open string. Actually, it's even more dramatic. So for open strings, instead of getting something like d to the fourth after the fourth, you get d squared after the fourth, already at 2 loops or something like that. And that was already, that was already seen by, you know, it's a 2-loop computation. People know how to do this in Yang-Mills. This is a 5 or 6-loop computation. Obviously, it hasn't been done yet. On the Feynman diagram side. No, so my language right now is in 10 dimensions, but of course you can translate into language in 4.
Oh no, there the loop goes up.
No, yeah. So that's right. So it's 7 loops in 10 became 9 loops in 4, and I think this is the 7 loop divergence in 4 dimensions where it is now. So the summary is that all the superspace people agree that at 5 loops, there should be a difference between, we expect a difference between the super Yang-Mills behavior and the supergravity behavior. And there are various arguments, and okay, I think the Tzvi people are still on four loops, but obviously if they can do five loops, then they can check it.
They're doing five loops.
They're doing, but yes.
They're doing
in progress.
I'm sorry? I'm not sure they're doing it in D dimensions.
Oh, I think they are. I mean, they usually do it in all dimensions at once. So they would have to do it in all dimensions at once to see this, that's right. But they certainly know that. Okay, are there any other comments? Okay, so so let me say something about this topological thing because Pedro asked and he's not here. But okay, so what is special about ABS as opposed to flat? So I already told you one thing that's special is that ABS 5 times S5 is a Lagrangian. Is PSU 2 4 invariant. So it's written just in terms of the supersymmetric currents, which the flat background is not. Now, there's another feature. So this suggests that the amplitude computation can be also done in a PSU 2 4 invariant way. Now, of course, in a flat background, we know. I mean, no is not too strong. There have been many no-go theorems proven showing that you can't write a 10-dimensional action in a manifestly space-time supersymmetric way. So the hope of being able to compute amplitudes in a manifestly space-time supersymmetric way, where manifestly space-time supersymmetric means off-shell space-time supersymmetric, I think probably is not going, I mean, I don't think it's going to be possible. To have an off-shell space-time supersymmetric either action or amplitude. Off-shell amplitude, where the states are off-shell? Correlation function. I don't know. In quantum field theory, we call them amplitudes, but off-shell amplitudes. In AGS5 times S5, there is this possibility. So certainly, we know how to write the amplitudes in a manifestly PSU2-4 invariant way using harmonic superspace, at least the simplest one, which we don't know in a flat background. Okay, so there are some things that can be done. So the ADS5 times S5, I'm not going to write the Lagrangian again, but there are certain properties of the Lagrangian which can be investigated. So for example, one property is in flat background, if you take Q, so we're doing now the type 2. If I take Q of the Lagrangian, I get the total derivative. So this is, of course, true in bosonic string theory also. It doesn't vanish, but it's a total derivative. If you take QQ bar of the Lagrangian, so this is the left and right moving your STO, but you get DD bar of something. We can do this in bosonic string theory, but in the flat background in the pure spinorforms, and the thing that it turns out to be dd bar of is this object here. So of course it has Gauss number 1, 1, and of course it has to be a scalar, and this is what it is. If you did it in bosonic string theory, if I'm not mistaken, it will be something like cc bar. DXM, D bar XM. It can't be DXM. I think it's. Okay, I give up. Maybe it's just CC bar. I don't remember anymore. I'll remember by the end of the. But in any case, this is what it is in a flat background. And you can see it's not this object here. If I call this object V, so this would be the vertex operator for the closed string state, which just deforms the Lagrangian. So it's the, if you like it, you can think of it as the trace of the graviton, or it changes the value of alpha prime. Now, just looking at it, it involves theta, so it's not manifestly space-time supersymmetric. So if you do a space-time supersymmetry transformation on it, you get something which is BRST trivial, which just means that the Lagrangian changes by something changes by a total derivative when you do a space-time supersymmetry transformation. So now if we do it in ADS, we know the Lagrangian, what you find is that it's dd bar of just lambda, lambda hat. So, well, actually, it's lambda, lambda hat, let me call it alpha hat, delta, alpha, alpha hat, where this is just the five-form gamma matrix. Now, this is, of course, manifestly PSU's 2-4 invariant. So this is just going to be identified with the radius modulus. So changing the value, I mean, inserting this vertex operator is just equivalent to modifying the radius of the ADS vector times S5. Now you can see this is lambda, alpha hat, lambda hat, lambda hat, which is in the cohomology. So V equals is in the cohomology. Whereas in, if you try to use this in a flat background, well, let's say for type 2A, where these have opposite chirality, you find that it'd be RST trivial. It's not the physical state. Okay, so this gives a new possibility, which is in ADS, we can identify, or we can attempt to identify lambda hat with lambda bar. Or more precisely, it's when I write with a down index, so lambda hat with a down index is going to be defined as delta alpha, alpha hat. Now we can identify lambda hat with lambda bar, okay, with this non-minimal variable. So instead of introducing non-minimal variables, so why did we have to introduce non-minimal variables here? So the reason was because well, we wanted to regularize this 0 over 0 here. Now we have a different...
I don't follow the logic why the fact that this was in the cohomology implies...
Okay, I said it fast, so let me... let me give the argument. Okay, good. So you would like to say... I didn't even say it. That's probably why you missed it. What does it mean to identify... something with lambda bar. You want lambda bar to be thought of as a complex conjugate, which means that lambda bar alpha is greater than or equal to 0. Okay. Now, if this thing is BRC trivial, it doesn't make sense to say that it's different from 0. Sorry, greater than 0, not greater. It's only 0 when lambda alpha equals 0. It wouldn't make sense to identify this is the complex conjugate, because I could always gauge this thing to be 0. So in some sense, it doesn't act like something which is positive definite. So the reason why this is greater than 0 is because I didn't mention this before, but you're not allowed to consider all the components of lambda vanishing. That's some singular point. Okay, so if it's in the cohomology, then there's nothing stopping you from just defining this to be some positive quantity. So it's some object which is in the cohomology, so I can think of it, I can treat it as something which is non-vanishing.
How come flat space cannot be dealt for when there's a limit of radius?
So you could have asked the question already here. So this Lagrangian is PSU2-4 invariant. Why isn't flat space also PSH24 invariant if it's the limit of ADS?
Can you take a limit to do rescale this generation slightly funny?
Right. So in that funny rescaling, you're doing something illegal here. So this thing, which is in the cohomology of ADS, when you do this funny rescaling, it suddenly becomes BRC trivial. So there's something singular in this limit.
The plane wave is more like ADS or like flat space?
It's like half and half. So some of the, it turns out that some of the lambdas you can treat as non-minimal variables and some of them you can't. So essentially half of them you can treat as half of the non-minimal variables.
Nathan, your lambdas up in the flat case, but just spins, Lorentz spins.
Yes.
What are they down here? I mean, the group is, the spinners of what? Not of SU2, too.
sorry, no, they're always, so in any curved background, they're always living in the tangent space of SO10, of the tangent space SO10. So they always parameterize this SO10 over U5. So, okay. So the point was that why did we have to introduce non-minimal variables here? It was because, well, we knew that we weren't going to be able to do an integral over just over 16 thetas. We had to somehow get 5 thetas, and that was what forced us to introduce the non-minimal variables. Here we don't have to do that. So in some sense, there's no reason why we should have introduced the non-minimal variables. But of course, we still have to define things like the B ghost. Okay, so okay.
So how would you compute the trilateral energy?
Good. Okay. So the good. So the prescription would be. Yes.
You were worrying a while ago about divergences that happen when lambda particles.
In flat background, yes.
And you just said lambda, lambda bar, doesn't it?
Well, now we're in ADS.
No, lambda bar, non-minimal.
Sorry. Okay. When this thing goes to zero...
It doesn't. You told me.
It can't be zero. I mean, well, obviously, lambda alpha, lambda bar alpha equals zero implies lambda alpha equals zero. So you can't set it to be equal to zero, but it can go as close as you want to zero. I mean, okay, let me try to say this in a clearer way. No, I agree with the confusion. I mean, okay, let me say it in a different way, which will maybe satisfy you, maybe won't. So suppose we allow, okay, this is not, this object here satisfies Q on it is equal to 1. It's the scale part which becomes singular. So it's the projective part is fine. It's the scale part which is singular. So if you allowed arbitrary functions of 1 over lambda lambda bar, then you this is just re-saying what I said before in a different way, but Q of this object is equal to 1. Q of this object is equal to 1. Which means that if you allow this type of object into your Hilbert space, the cohomology would become trivial. So you just multiply this times any object, and you can write any object as Q of something. This object is not allowed, essentially because when I do the expansion of this denominator, you'll eventually get 11 powers of lambda lambda bar in the denominator. So this thing, if you expand it out, has a term which goes like lambda lambda bar to the 11th times r theta to the 10th times theta lambda bar. So this thing diverges too fast. But this object is still allowed. Okay, so what, because it doesn't go like 1 over lambda lambda bar to the 11th. So I mean, I'm looking for something that can play this role without using lambda bar.
But how important was it to be integrating into the scale of lambda as well as just the, I mean, it's all that that's causing these problems.
Important. So you need, the scale plays an important role. You won't get, I mean, you can't, the scale is essentially the ghost number, the ghost. You have to integrate over it. Otherwise, you don't get the right amplitude. So, It's important and it causes complications, but it's important. Okay, so let me go back to the ADS just because I'm running out of time. So we're going to treat lambda tilde as lambda bar for various reasons. One reason is because we didn't have to introduce lambda, the non-minimal variables, to do the integration over superspace. The second reason is because this is in the cohomology, so in some sense it makes sense to divide by it. Okay, in some sense. Okay. Whereas if it was BRST trivial, it would make no sense to divide by it. Okay, so...
why do you consider Euclidean ADS5? I'm confused.
So I've been...
People are careless. Interested in Minkowski signature, right?
Yeah, so I've been careless about the signatures throughout all the lectures. And I guess I have never run into a situation where the choice of signature causes problems. So I don't know.
You just use that it's positive. If it's not Euclidean, then lambda bar is not conjugate, it's not positive.
That's right. And if it's not Euclidean, then also the complex conjugate of this is not the spinner of this chirality. If I was doing Minkowski, it would be the same chirality. So I agree. So all I can say is this Gaussian integration. The Gaussian integration only makes sense if this is, you know, taken to be some the square of some object. You know, but of course I can always Wick rotate to something which I know how to do. So I'm just assuming that I can always do this Wick rotation and leave it at that. I'm not worried about subtleties with Wick rotation. Just because I've never had to worry about it.
So when you say PSU2, I mean already you're in Minkowski.
Yeah, okay. So
it has to be in Lorentz signature for that.
Okay. So these are the kinds of questions that I agree with you that that all these signature questions I have never worried about, and okay, some people worry about it. I have never worried about it, and so far it hasn't become a problem. I do Wick rotation in the end. I do a computation. I do Wick rotation in the end and get what I want. You're not satisfied.
Well, up to now, you might have been satisfied, but if you're going to identify a spinner with an opposite chirality spinner, then
no, that's...
And it starts depending exactly what signature you're in.
Okay, so let me give you a signature in which everything that I say is okay. So let's say we're working in...
But then it has to make sense, you know.
No, so it's something like PSL 4/4. So in that case, almost everything is real. I mean, yes. You're not going to be happy. Mathematician is not going to be happy, but a physicist normally is happy. I mean, if I get to the final answer.
That's going to correspond to the split signature.
Fine, okay, yes. And? As I said, if you can get the number out, I'm happy. If you can't, you can complain. But for these amplitudes, you could have said, well, so Paul already complained that lambda is not real. You could have complained, well, it's SO91, not SO10.
Right?
Yeah, he already complained. So, but what we do is we just complexify everything inside, and then in the end you restrict to real momentum, or you pick some stupid signature that nobody wants, like SO5,5, and then you Wick rotate in the end. I mean,
no, that's going to be dangerous.
Okay. And I guess I'm not to it.
That's only one issue. Chirality is another one.
Sorry?
You're right, though. I complained about the fact that it's complex.
Yeah.
I think the complaint that it's... any complaints about being what the chirality are...
So let's do Euclidean.
...are different complaints.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So I'm happy to do Euclidean.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so... I mean, all I want to do is to get some understanding of the formalism. I mean, the details we can decide later, but I'm still trying to understand the formula. Okay, so the idea is that you integrate over just lambdas and... Okay, so the question was about tree amplitude. Okay, so let me call it D32 theta. So I have 32 thetas. And then I have to do something with the lambdas. So obviously, I'm going to have some expression like lambda... I could call it lambda hat or lambda bar. It doesn't matter anymore. And I want to do this computation here. Now, the integration of the thetas no longer kills it, because now you have as many factors as of 1 over the radius of ADS as you need to get something dimensionally correct. Of course, one still has to do the integration over the lambdas. And the conjecture is now that lambda lambda hat cubed, I'm going to identify to be 1. So this is lambda alpha. So this is a conjecture. I mean, the easiest thing to prove about the conjecture is that it's PSU224 invariant. Now, for 3-point amplitude, PSU224 invariant fixes the answer up to an overall coefficient. So as long as I can argue that this is non-zero, I'm essentially finished. And of course, then if it works for 3-point, you can say, well, now I just put in, for 4-point, I just add, you know, the integrated vertex operators. So that would be the prescription. So, and of course, there's D10x. And then you have to do things correctly.
You want to have zero most integral?
I'm sorry, just one second. You also have to put in the super Virabhaian of the. What was the question?
If at the massless state, you still only have zero mode integrals.
I only have zero modes. That's right. Okay. If I do 3-point.
Can you just do that?
Yes, I mean, but has it been done? No. So what you would have to do is you would have to expand this up to 32 powers of theta and show that you get something non-vanishing. No, it hasn't been done. Can it be done? I think so, yes.
That's one of the cases over there.
Yeah, I agree. Somebody that knows mathematics. yeah, so...
What is the wave function that you would use in ADS? You can be playing with the complex
space. I can do all at once. So this is the... I can use plane... Well, so these are the 10-dimensional supergravity superfields. And now you can look for any solution. So you could choose a plane wave solution if you wanted. So the difficulty is that the answer is known, but the answer is not written as an expression over 32 thetas. It's written as an expression over just harmonic superspace. So the thing that I would like to be able to do, which I don't know how to do, is to express this as an integration over just, well, it's usually written over 4 x's, then you have something like 8 thetas, and you have some 4 u's, and then you have some expression, some superfields that just depends on x theta and u. And this, for the 3-point, has been known for 15 years, 20 years.
You wouldn't be satisfied by just looking at the lowest weight in the multiplet?
Like I would be. Once I do it for any one, as long as I get something non-zero, I'm finished. There's nothing
so
else.
What are the 4-point? So different function? Okay, it's known. So the 4-point function, how far?
I have to do the 3-point function first.
No, I would not.
You believe it, okay. So how much is known about the 4-point function?
Yes.
I mean, I know the vertex operator, but I don't know how to compute the OPEs. So you would have to do it in some background field expansion.
Okay.
How much is known? Well, I can do the background. People have done background field expansion using ADS. I don't know, expansion.
Different functions for gravity state is boring. I mean,
for example, yes.
But the four is definitely not.
Yes, I agree.
So, I mean, there would be a lot of structure.
Yes. So,
again,
I need somebody else who knows mathematics.
Okay,
so
I'm the wrong guy.
People have done these background field expansions. So, for example, people like Valilu and Mazzucato and people who looked at the OPs. There was a paper today by Benicio. I suspect he also used this kind of stuff. So there are techniques for using background field expansion. It's just, you know, it's order by order, and it takes some level of computer knowledge, probably. But the 3-point, I would think that there's some nice way to get to this without using a computer, but maybe I'm wrong. Okay, so but that's the 3-point and 4-point. That's the general idea that you want to generalize. Okay, so the next thing was the B-ghost. So the B-ghost, it turns out, in some sense, is simpler than this, which is not surprising because you don't have these non-minimal variables. So the B ghost, which satisfies Q with B is T. So this was done together with Mazzucato. It's essentially just the first term here. So you write lambda bar alpha, where now this is the right moving. It's not no longer non-minimal. So now you have JA. It's just whatever you call pi and D now becomes these supersymmetric currents. So it's just JA, gamma A, J alpha. So these were the fermionic supersymmetric currents. These are the bosonic ones. And then you also have a term in the second type. Okay, and that's it. So Q on this gives you T. You can show the Q bar on B gives you zero. Now, the only thing that's funny is the D bar of B is not zero. So it's not holomorphic. That's because of this right-moving ghost. But it turns out to be Q of something. So that's called Q of omega, Q of lambda, let's say. And it's easy to find out what is lambda. Okay. Now, this is enough to make sense out of these kinds of loop expressions, because what it means is that the Beltrami differential is defined up to D bar of something. But when you take D bar of this, it gives you something BRST trivial, which you can then pull off to the surface. OK, so this is a new structure. I don't know people that have discussed string theories where the B ghost is not holomorphic. But in general, in curved backgrounds, in this pure spinorforms, and the B ghost will not be holomorphic. OK, so that's one more feature. Now, there's one more thing that I wanted to discuss.
So there is no pole in lambda, lambda.
Right. It was a little. Certainly, in a flat background, there's no pole.
No, you were saying before that there were poles, but now they disappeared.
Right? Oh, sorry, sorry. No, the poles that I mentioned.
In B.
Sorry. Yeah. You're right. Thank you.
There's
that was the pole. Sorry. I'm sorry. You need a one over lambda. That one you didn't get rid of. Yeah, you're right. Thank you. Okay, so there's one more thing I want to say. Let me say it very quickly, which is this ADS might be related to something that was suggested about these n equals 2 topological. So,
do you still need a regulator?
Yeah, you're asking about loop amplitudes and things like that. Yes, I mean, I haven't even, without thinking about it, the answer is yes. But I haven't thought about it seriously. Let me just say some words. When the radius of ADS goes to zero, one might hope that the Lagrangian becomes something simple, just because it's supposed to describe perturbative superyang nils. So one possibility, and there's certain pieces of evidence for this possibility, is that it's described by a G over G model. So let me just say, let me just say the words. You choose G PSU224. And the idea is that the object is the theory is topological because you have as many gauge invariances as you have Wilczek degrees of freedom. But of course, in order to describe the theory, you have to gauge fix. In order to compute anything, you have to gauge fix this. And there are different possible gauge fixings. And one possible gauge fixing is which you leave SO41 times SO5 in here, but you gauge fix the rest of it to zero. So that's going to plus ghosts, which describe this PSH24 over which comes from the gauge fixing. Now, there are ways of describing these ghosts in such a way that they essentially resemble these pure spinner degrees of freedom. So there are ways to repackage. Obviously, I have as many bosonic as fermionic degrees of freedom. You have 10 x's, 22 pure spinners, and 32 thetas. So you have an equal number of bosons and fermions, which is, of course, also true in this topological. And in fact, that's something I forgot to mention. When you do loop amplitudes, the partition functions, you never have to compute because you have an equal number of bosons and fermions at each conformal weight, so they always cancel. So that's also true in topological streams. So that suggests that there might be some relation between this formalism and topological strings. And in ADS, it seems more likely. So the conjecture was that when R goes to zero, it's described by some topological string theory of this type. And you do a deformation by some operator in the cohomology, and it turns into the ADS size and this type. So this is some radius deformation. You deform by the radius modulus, and it turns this topological model into this Lagrange. Okay, so I don't have much time. I don't want to spend more time on this, but I think that's at least something that's worth looking into, in the sense that the fact that you have a string theory that's supposed to describe perturbative super-Yang nils, for me, that wouldn't be surprising. Witten, the reason why he started studying twister string theory was also essentially to try to understand this R goes to zero limit. So of course, he came up with something which was unrelated to ADS, but the fact that you have a topological string theory that describes n equals 4 super-Yang nils suggests that it might be related to this topological string theory here. Now, of course, this is going to be just free super-Yang nils until you deform it. So in some sense, it's even simpler.
Which part of this proposal is a conjecture? You start with the topological model and you deform it, you get ADS phi crosses phi action. Is that right?
Yeah, so that's right. So you choose the deformation so that you land on the ADS phi times S phi Lagrange. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Now, the part that is not understood is this gauge fixing. So what you want to show is that the BRST operator in this model turns into the BRST operator in this model. Now, so this is one thing that needs to be understood better. So here, of course, the BRST operator is built out of a pure spinner lambda, okay, which has, it has 11, let me write it as 11 degrees of freedom. The way it's described here, so this gauge fixing here, of course, you get 32 fermions, and you have 10 bosons coming from this gauge fixing. And these are somehow going to go into the lambda and lambda hat, the 22 from these. So this is 32 fermions and 10 bosons. Sorry, the ghosts, of course, flip the statistics. So because these are ghosts, this goes into boson, this goes into fermion. And you want to show that this the way they come in, these can be reabsorbed into these 11 plus 11 pure spinners. So there have been some papers on, so there were some old papers by Isaka and Kazama who tried to interpret pure spinners as coming from some unconstrained degrees of freedom. So, of course, it was an old problem to try to understand these constrained ghosts as coming from gauge fixing. And essentially what they did is they proposed that it came from something like this. You start with two unconstrained spinners, so these are these 32 bosons, and then you have these 10 fermions which impose this additional constraint. Okay, so they did it in flat background, and things didn't quite work out. In ADS, it's somehow more natural. So if you get these 32 and 10 coming from this kind of gauge fixing, at least, so in this paper I wrote, I think, 2 years ago, I explained more or less how you can argue that it goes into this. But, it's formal manipulations. Okay, then you have to show that the cohomology from here is related to the cohomology from here. So how do you do that? Well, you have to compute the cohomology here. So what should you get? You should get, well, the half BPS states, but also all the other non-BPS states at zero Tuft coupling. So the half BPS states are more or less easy to get. It's the non-BPS states that are difficult to get. So that's the part of the conjecture. So maybe the conjecture needs to be reduced to just to say you only know how to describe the half BPS states. That's a possibility. In that sense, instead of this topological model describing the full ADS, it just describes some half BPS sector. That maybe is more likely, but it certainly is less useful. I think what I would like to say is that somehow the non-BPS states are also described here at zero Tuft coupling. And that certainly, I think, I don't have any good ideas about how to get the non-BPS sector from this. So that's essentially where it is today. Of course, if you could, the next thing would be to try to compute amplitude at zero coupling here. And of course, we know the answer, and it should somehow just reproduce the perturbative superangle, or the free superangles computations. But that, okay, I think it's fair to say until I understand, until someone understands the non-BPS sector, it's really conjecture. Okay, other questions?
You could compute amplitude results BPS.
In principle, you could. So we tried to do, together with Andrei Mikhailov, we tried. The non-trivial part is that there are coefficients coming from the normalization of the three-point that we didn't get successfully. So if you compute three-point functions of, let's say, half BPS operators of different amounts of angular momentum, you should get some dependence on that those different amounts. And we weren't able to reproduce that. But I can't say we thought about it very deeply, but that seems to be the only thing to check, because obviously PSU24 invariants take care of everything else.
Well, but that doesn't mean that you have to not, whether the function is normalized or not. Until a three-point function, the only one I'm meaning is a normalized three-point function.
Okay. And that does depend on the...
Yes.
Yeah, so there is a non-trivial check of the three-point function.
But I'm saying that, do you know that you're being the three-point function or the normalized three-point?
Are you suggesting that maybe there's no way to get the normalized three-point function output?
No, I'm not
suggesting
anything.
No, but you're suggesting something with your question, so I'm trying to get what you're
saying.
Suggest.
Saying that
you have to compute two-point function.
You have to compute two-point functions to normalize the three-point function in so that it has an invariant meaning.
Okay, so the question is, can you compute two-point functions in string theory? I think the answer should be yes, but okay. Okay. I don't.
Usually, string theory, we say we don't know how to do that because on the sphere we have the form of Killing back.
So in a flat background we don't, but I think in an ADS you should be able to. So you have a radius parameter. I mean, maybe I'm saying something naive, but
sorry,
in ADS.
No, I'm saying from the worst point of view. I mean, for the rules of string theory, you divide the volume of case transformation.
I think the computation to do is you do a three-point computation, but where one of the vertex operators is just the radius modulus.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this tells you is the dependence of the two-point function on the radius modulus, which I think is the information you're asking about, right?
Yeah.
It's just, so I think this would be the computation you would do in the string theory. It's a three-point function, but the third one is just the radius modulus, so it just tells you how the two-point function depends on the radius.
Even without the radius dependence, you get something like trivial, you get some expansion or whatever.
No, but n is the radius, right?
No, n radius is lambda. Not at lambda.
Sorry, where, this is a tree-level computation.
On the sphere.
Yes, on the sphere.
Yes.
So there's only one parameter, right? I don't know if you call it Tuft couplet or radius parameter, but there's only one parameter.
Mm-hmm.
So once I have the dependence of this parameter, essentially I know everything I can know. So I think, I don't know, I wouldn't know how to compute this directly because obviously it has the wrong Gauss number. But I think this thing you should be able to compute. So, okay, that's, so to answer Jean's question, I think, yeah, you would have to compute this and the three-point function, and then there would be some relative coefficients you would have to check. Sorry?
It has not been done yet.
Has not been done yet. I think it's been attempted, but it has not been done in a way that you get the right answer. But obviously, the people doing the computation are not, we're not specialists in this, so we may have just done it wrong. Okay, are there other questions? Okay, thanks.